Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The U.S. Justice Department, as you've been hearing in the news this morning, is now investigating whether Baltimore City Police violated the civil rights of Freddie Gray, the 25-year-old who died Sunday, a week after he was injured while in police custody. Protesters have gathered at the Baltimore Police Department's Western District headquarters each evening since last weekend. Here's one protester on Monday night.
This our beef. They men like us. They men. We want respect. They didn't respect that boy. They threw him in a paddy wagon, and he's laid in a coma. We men, we human beings. He wasn't no dog. He wasn't no animal. I was somebody's son. I don't give a what he sold out here. I don't give a what he did past prior to this. He's a child. A child of God. That deserve that.
Police arrested Gray after a foot chase in Baltimore's Sandtown-Winchester neighborhood. A police report obtained by the Baltimore Sun said Gray was, quote, arrested without force or incident, close quote. The question investigators are trying to answer, how was he injured? Officials say they will conclude their criminal investigation by May 1st. With me by phone to talk through some of the questions this case raises is Susan Gehring, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland. Welcome back to the show, Susan.
Thank you so much, Sheila.
And also joining us by phone is David Gray, a University of Maryland law professor who teaches criminal law and criminal procedure. Welcome.
Good morning.
David Gray, let's start at the beginning, at the point when the police first encountered Freddie Gray. The police account does not say he was doing anything illegal. He simply ran from them when they made eye contact. They chased and arrested him. What are the legal questions raised here?
Questions really come into three categories. The first is constitutional questions governed by the Fourth Amendment. Second are tort questions that would be governed by Maryland common law. And finally, criminal law questions governed by Maryland common law. And so those questions come down to basically, were his civil rights violated? Were his rights violated such that he or his family could bring a tort action against the police? And finally, were the police perhaps criminally responsible for his death? And so I'll talk about the civil rights issues first, and because I think those are the most important right now. And those are governed by the Fourth Amendment, which requires that all seizures be reasonable. And so we have questions here about whether the initial stop and subsequent arrest were reasonable. Did the police have reasonable suspicion to believe that Mr. Gray was involved in criminal activity when they stopped him? Then did they subsequently have probable cause to believe that he'd committed a crime when they arrested him? And then finally, was there use of force at the stop, at the arrest, and any subsequent moment when he was in police custody reasonable? And all these are governed by the Fourth Amendment and basically require a balancing of police interests and citizen interests. And with respect to the stop, the most important case on point is a Supreme case called Illinois versus Wardlow, which was decided in 2000. And in that case, law enforcement officers stopped an individual who was fleeing from what police described as a high crime area. When police converged on that high crime area, and the Supreme Court, through the pen of Chief Justice Rehnquist, said that fleeing from police officers itself is not enough to demonstrate reasonable suspicion to justify a seizure. Neither is being in a high crime area enough, but in some circumstances, fleeing from police in a high crime area in combination with other facts may be sufficient to provide reasonable suspicion. So at this point, I think we're really waiting for what those other facts are. What specific facts gave the law enforcement officers articulable suspicion to conduct a stop here? And
David,
then what additional facts they gathered in order to justify the arrest?
I'm interested, David, I'm interested that you you pointed to the high crime area. Susan Gehring, that's how I've heard police describe the area in which Freddie Gray was apprehended. Are there different standards for different locations? Might the decision about whether this was an appropriate stop be different because it was a high crime area compared to a regular area?
Well, the Supreme Court language in that case is a little bit ambivalent. It was viewing what was happening in that case. So you have to sort of argue from what was happening in that case. I would submit that the policy, if it isn't the policy, it ought to be the policy that people get a fair shake regardless of where they are standing or running or walking, and that ought to be the law. And I'd argue that Supreme Court case encompasses that that kind of an equality. So I think that What Billy Murphy, who's the attorney for the family, said is absolutely true. Running away from the police, especially when they're in fear of the police, is not a crime. Running is not a crime.
Commissioner Batt said the same thing at a press conference. Running is not a crime. David Gray, the Department of Justice, as I mentioned, has launched a civil rights investigation in the Ferguson case. After the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, the Department of Justice found no civil rights violation. Would just on the face of it, you think a different result in Baltimore?
So I agree with the mayor on this, at least, that we need to know all the facts before we make those kinds of judgments. And we just don't know all the facts here. I was interested to hear your account of the police report, which described the arrest as without incident. But I'd also like to know what was in the police report in terms of the facts that the police cited in justifying the stop and arrest in the first place. And then finally, I just want to agree wholeheartedly with what was Ms. Herring's comment that just because you happen to live in a certain neighborhood doesn't mean that you should have diminished expectations of privacy, diminished Fourth Amendment rights. And I'm deeply critical of the Wardlow case and the Terry case that preceded it insofar as they have had the effect of dramatically diminishing the effective civil rights that many of our fellow citizens have, depending on where they live.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with David Gray of the University of Maryland Law School and Susan Gehring, Executive Director of the ACLU of Maryland, talking about the death of Freddie Gray, the 25-year-old Baltimore man who died Sunday, a week after sustaining a spinal injury in police custody. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, Deputy Police Commissioner, have been holding press conferences. Here's Deputy Police Commissioner Jerry Rodriguez at a press conference on Monday.
We know the injuries that Mr. Gray sustained. We know the final outcome of Mr. Gray is, unfortunately, he passed away. What we don't have at this point is how Mr. Gray sustained those injuries. We are working tirelessly. As the commissioner stated, we have appointed folks to our task force that will work solely on this. We will continue to work closely with the state's attorney's office to get to the fact, to get to the truth.
David Gray, if the police officers involved are not talking or are not talking candidly, what evidence could investigators try to assemble to get at what happened in that van?
So one of the great gifts that we have in our age of surveillance is that that cameras, public cameras, private cameras operated by banks or security cameras operated by stores, cameras on cell phones, that surveillance age has put all of us under increased visual surveillance, but it's also put police officers under increased surveillance. And so what we've seen in a number of these police violence and police use of force incidents recently, and most recently in South Carolina, is that eventually videos have surfaced and people are more likely to view those videos with the proper scrutiny that they deserve, and to use them to criticize police activity. So we could hope for some kind of actual visual evidence acquired, hopefully from a neutral party or from police officials. But outside of that, we have to rely on the word of police officers. And I think it's perfectly appropriate to treat the word of police officers in these kind of cases with a level of suspicion.
And Sheila, if I could just add something, I think one of the things that the Department of Justice investigators bring is that there is going to be a level of trust as they go door to door, in some cases, I hope, and try to find witnesses, because we know there were witnesses just from the video so far, a level of trust that is not present for the Baltimore City Police. This has been, we're talking about decades of brutality and police misconduct that our clients, African Americans who come to us, often report, but nobody knows for sure that it's true except the people living in those neighborhoods. And now that we have, as Professor Gray pointed out, we have access to videotapes, that of course is a really big boon to the investigation. But I think what we also need to do is also just be open to talking about that. The other thing is, I have to say that the police have been very untransparent whenever somebody in their fold has been charged with misconduct. And this goes back, again, for decades. It goes back to the 1970s, actually, when the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights was passed and protected police officers often to the disadvantage of the neighborhoods and also the public in general, because there is a real close investigation that is not transparent. And I think that I'm sad to say that in this case, the police, I think, had the statement of charges at least a week before they were finally disclosed, I think, by the newspapers.
Susan,
that is not a good sign.
Susan, we have just a minute left before we have to break for the national news, and I want to ask you about the report that the ACLU of Maryland put together. It found 109 deaths in the state of Maryland in police custody between 2010 and 2014. What of your findings is most pertinent to this Freddie Gray situation?
Sure. Well, I think the fact that let's look at the statistic for people by race. 69% of those who died of the 109 were black. And the blacks only make up 29% of the Maryland population. So 5 black people died at the hands of police officer for every white person who died. Then you look at the statistics for people who were unarmed, because, of course, this person was unarmed. 41% of those who died were not armed with a weapon of any kind. And then if you compare unarmed black people, 10 unarmed black people died for every unarmed white person. And even when you take the number of people in the whole population, the rate at which unarmed blacks die in a police encounter was 10%.
Susan, I know there's much more we should know about the report, and we should talk another time. I really appreciate your both joining us.
Sure.
Susan Gehring, Executive Director of the ACLU of Maryland, David Gray, the University of Maryland Law Professor. We have a link to the ACLU report on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.